Right then, we've dwelt on mortality long enough. 2016 is but a dim memory. It's now time for 2017, where nothing will ever go wrong. This is the Linux Voice Podcast. We are Series 5, and you are Episode 1. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this fun-packed and completely non-Bowie death-filled episode, we've got...
You mentioned it.
Well, yeah, of course, because it's a cultural touchstone that will affect us forever. We've got news, we've got anything else, we've got finds, we've got neurons, and we have our voice of the masses. Somewhere in there will be a halfway reminder. There'll be a couple of liberal recommendations and exhortations.
Liberal?
What?
Left-wing liberal.
Left-wing liberal. Communists. Yes.
Metropolitan elite.
That's me. Here I am in North Yorkshire being on Metropolitan and Elite.
Labour's got quite a challenge with this Section 50 vote.
It must be really difficult to vote for the government.
Oh, dear.
No, sorry.
Go on, let's get this podcast over with so I can get on with filling in the forms to become a Labour candidate. We've got news and ting and the rest of the podcast, but also we now contribute a great big chunky section called Linux Voice to Linux Magazine, which you can buy at all good newsagents, probably some rubbish ones as well, actually, and some supermarkets, and you can also subscribe. The URL will be in the podcast notes. Without further ado, it's time for the news.
For the news, we'll start off our news with some sad news. The last celebrity death of 2016 was CyanogenMod. It probably wasn't the last celebrity death, was it? There's too many of them to count.
No, Princess Leia.
Princess Leia, was that 2016?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, it was. It's already blurred. The last Linux-related celebrity death, and possibly the first as well, I can't remember, of 2016 was CyanogenMod. It's the what is it? It's a build of a distribution of Android, but with Google stuff removed or possibly included if you want, but leaving you the choice to sort of put it together how you want. It sort of ended up becoming a company, then having a spat within the company, then a bit of a slap fight. Then some of the people who were CyanogenMod were no longer CyanogenMod, and it ended up dying. But fret no more, for it rises from the ashes as Lineage OS. It's almost rises from the ashes. It's on its way up, at least. You can't yet download fully built images for various Android devices, but it's on its way there. The build systems are up and running, the stuff's coming together. And it will soon be a brand spanking new distribution of Android that can be freer than Google's version, that you can put onto most, if not all, of your Android devices, should you wish to.
So I haven't read too much into this, but isn't it some members of the community or the more community-focused members of the CyanogenMod team? Basically, it's a kind of a fork. They didn't like the way that CyanogenMod was going. Because I remember seeing the stories pop up at Reddit over Christmas, and there was all kinds of horrible things going on, like the DNS entries being taken down for CyanogenMod and people not being able to get their updates. And it seemed quite a fractious end.
It's hard to know exactly what happened, but CyanogenMod, the guy who started it all, founded the company, and they took on sort of all sorts of funding, and with the venture capital funding, in came a load of sort of management people who, I don't want to say they didn't understand what it was about, but they ran the business as though they didn't understand what it was about.
Yeah.
And so CyanogenMod has left the company, And he is now part of Lineage as well. So it is a lot of the core people. It is basically the people who were CyanogenMod, at least from the open source side, are now with Lineage. And yeah, CyanogenMod no longer exists. CyanogenOS, which is the sort of commercial build of CyanogenMod, doesn't exist or is about to stop existing. And the company Cyanogen Inc. exists, but it's kind of, they've had to fire a load of people, and it's not entirely clear what they're going to do. Although their press release mumbles something about providing services to people who use or manufacturers of Android on phones.
Right. I mean, I actually stopped using CyanogenMod about 6 months ago because, for my devices anyway, if there is an AOS and an Android open source project build, it seemed better. It was less tainted. I think AOSP is basically it's like Chromium. It's just the open source code from Android built, basically.
I mean, the advantage of CyanogenMod, there were images for almost everything.
Yes, and they did a great job. The project itself did an amazing job, really, at semi-popularizing or legitimizing install-it-yourself Android operating systems on your own phone. So,
yeah, I mean, it's not hard to install, but it's, you know, there's a bit of poking around and twiddling things.
Yeah.
And considering that is, you know, it did get quite popular.
Yeah. I mean, there's always a risk of bricking your phone as well, which, when these things now cost like £700, £800, £1,200 in the post-Brexit economy. You know,
what phone costs £1,200?
Well, the Google Pixel, for example, is the Pixel XL, I think, is like £900, £800.
And that's all Nigel Farage's fault.
Is that before or after the dollar crashes?
Yeah. that was actually the pre-Brexit price, so Google hasn't yet put up its prices. But it's still such a lot of money. But then you wouldn't want to necessarily with the Pixel because it's already running Android.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still running CyanogenMod on my tablet, which I probably should switch to Lineage when it comes out. All it really does is control my stereo, so.
Yeah.
It does a great job. Right, should we move on to the next item of news? And that is that Dell loves Linux, or at least it claims to, as it's making apparently tens of millions of dollars off its laptops and the Project Sputnik range. This is it comes under various names, the XPS 13, the Sputnik Edition, the Developer Edition, I think it's called as well, which is their sort of high-end laptop, which comes with Ubuntu pre-installed. And they've sold loads of them.
Is this range, is it just the XPS models, or do they have anything else?
It was originally just one XPS model, then I think there was a couple more XPS models, and now they're introducing the Precision range, which is a sort of, I don't want to say mid-range, but more mid-range compared to the XPS.
Right, yeah, because the XPS is a bit costly, as I recall. Although I've sampled it a bit at Graham's house. I think you got one, didn't you, Graham?
I was loaned one. Unfortunately, they wanted it back, but for the 6 months that I had it, I really liked it. At the time, I mean, I think in one of the old magazines, this project was his name has gone past me now. But it was a project basically started off for like just a set of developers who needed a set of core tools, working on cloud images and things like that. And so in the early days, I mean, in that XPS in particular, I remember they'd put the Wi-Fi unit in there, didn't have Linux drivers. I keep reading about things where there are, you know, bad hardware choices, but overwhelmingly great news that there are enough people, you know, buying these things to allow Dell to expand it. I mean, that's brilliant. I wonder if this is brought on by Apple's MacBook strategy.
Yeah, I was just about to mention the same thing as well. I mean, you know, looking at Hacker News and Reddit, I know they're hardly you know, represent the world at large. But when you see so many people annoyed by the new MacBook Pro, it's, you know, painfully thin keyboard and ridiculous pricing as well. The XPS, just when I played around with it at your place, Graham, it had really good build quality, a pretty decent keyboard. I think it was still a bit lacking in the touchpad, you know, few laptops really compared to MacBooks in terms of the touchpad. But yeah, let's hope this actually means a proper commitment to Linux from Dell. You know, they and other laptop manufacturers have toyed with Linux pre-installs over the years, and you know, it's never really gone anywhere, so hopefully this will work out.
Yeah, I remembered it was Barton George is the name of the person at Dell who I still think manages it. And the interesting thing, you bring up the touchpad, because that was one of those things where it was badly chosen, because there wasn't even a Linux driver at the time. Barton had to work with developers to create a driver, which is part of the reason why, even though it was like 10 multi-touch capable, it had very basic input. Yeah, that was a big weakness at the time.
Yeah, and yeah, just mentioning the Apple situation again, a lot of people are saying, you know, when they look at their workflows, do they really need OS X? They spend most of their time in a terminal using Vim, you know, SSHing into remote machines, running Docker and stuff. You know, how much do people actually need OS X then? It was always the go-to shiny Unix environment that would just work.
Yeah.
But you could say that now about many Linux distros, and when they're pre-packaged with a well-built laptop, then I think a lot of people who don't need Adobe CS can more easily switch to Dell.
And don't you see that so many people seem to be running the command line now? Like, it is their desktop environment. I get the feeling from more and more people getting into, like, command line apps for everything, that, you know, people are just kind of shunning the desktop, whatever that is, and using it simply for Vim or tmux and all the other things that go along with it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's a great tmux tutorial in a recent issue of Linux magazine in the Linux voice section. My voice is actually going now, as you can hear. I've been talking for 3 hours at a workshop, but I'll try to carry on.
Thanks, Mike.
We need a command line mic.
I could get a voice synthesizer for the next podcast.
Yeah. I know where I work, almost everyone now has switched to Linux. There's within the tech team, I think 2 people out of 50 use Windows, and I think only 1 person uses Mac OS, and everyone else uses Linux. And we just have blank laptops and you can put whatever you want on them. In fact, they come as Windows laptops. And everyone's decided at various points to switch to Linux. And I think within the tech sphere, it's certainly doing well.
Yeah, and maybe some people are also realizing that the command line, when implemented correctly, is not actually that difficult. I've always had this sort of opinion or idea that the command line is actually better than the GUI, because you can just say exactly what you want to do. You know, when you're using GUIs, especially ones changing all the time, like in Google's software, you know, click this button that looks a bit like a hamburger with a slash across it. Like, what's that? Whereas the command line, you tell someone, type in xq:\4, and it does Y. Yeah. Job's a good one.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of it's got to do with what most developers are writing for. But I mean, back in the day, most programmers, you know, professional programmers, would have written apps for Windows or a desktop. Now it's a huge proportion going to be writing either server software or mobile apps, neither of which you can develop directly on.
That's a good point. Yeah. People are developing server apps, and people are using server apps more and more as well, aren't they? A lot of people, like my parents, just need a web browser. They're running Linux Mint. They have no idea. They don't care. But they do everything in a web browser, so the operating system is egal. How do you say that in English? Oh.
Well, it means equal, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's not important to them, yeah.
Have we mined the story as deep as we can go with barely mentioning Dell at all?
Yeah, well done, Dell.
Yeah. Right, next up on our list of news is that I didn't actually know where to put this in my finds or in the news, but I put it in the news because why not? This is that you can now boot the Raspberry Pi without the firmware blobs.
Ooh.
This is basically a project, and I'm just looking on my notes, and I've only put the name of the website down, not the actual... No, it's actually called that as well, CRNA. I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that. Kerner! Maybe. Would be how they pronounce it in Bristol, anyway.
CRNA.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Kerner.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a project to basically allow you to run entirely free software on the Raspberry Pi. And it works up until a point now in that you can boot a version of Linux. You can't do an awful lot with it once it's booted because it doesn't communicate with much other than the UART. But I think it's... Although I do use plenty of proprietary drivers and whatnot, I do like the fact that there is a big push towards... Or a small push, a push anyway, towards completely open source systems that that we can use.
Yeah, me too. I think it's important. I think, you know, with it's the same with the projects to decode or sidestep Intel's embedded kind of microcode OS in the CPU. You know, I probably, it's too technical for me. But at least at the moment, I really like the idea that if I need to, if there was ever a need to, you can go to something where you can see every single line of code, you know, from the very moment the machine boots.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it gives you that sort of warm feeling inside that you can't quite explain, but you know, it's yeah. Fundamentally a good thing.
Yeah. If there was ever a nuclear war, you know, we can take all these devices into our bunker for 3 years and come out with, you know, fully fledged computers. And we won't need anything else other than, you know, a local mirror of GitHub.
3 years after nuclear winter, we'll have Doom running on everything.
You say if there were a nuclear war, that sounds like you think it might not happen.
Stupidly, I got used to the idea that it would never happen, so I'm still, you know, defrosting my 80s Cold War rhetoric.
To be fair, whatever happens in the UK, we probably can't start one with Trident just flying off in all directions. We'll destroy the Mid-Atlantic.
Well, no, we could start one, but with completely the wrong people.
Yes, it'd be Norway.
Right, staying on the theme of keeping things open and moving towards everything being running freely and making Richard Stallman happy, is that shipping has started on the first open hardware microcontrollers. And this open hardware is one of those things that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And in this, you mean it's microcontrollers where the chips themselves are open. They're using the RISC-V instruction set. And actually, I'm not sure which implementation that they're using. But it's, you can actually, the source code from which the chips are built is open and inspectable in the same way software is, and that sort of, yeah, well, open source software is anyway. And that, yeah, that, what we call the hardware description language is compiled to make the chips, which sounds a bit mad, really. But it's,
yeah, it does. It sounds mad that you can build hardware, but I guess that, yeah, you've explained this before, that, you know, components are still more efficient at doing certain specific tasks than computers are.
Yeah, and these are, they're not like full computery things that you can run Linux on and that sort of thing. They're little microcontrollers that you can use to, I don't know. What can you use microcontrollers for? Turn your gardening watering system on and off.
Yeah.
Which is what I want to use mine for. Yeah, so they can handle small computing tasks and they're completely open.
Yeah, that's cool. They seem to be more expensive than Raspberry Pis though, which...
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the fact that they're not mass-produced commodity hardware. Yeah. They're not set-top box with most of the bits cut out like Raspberry Pis are. They are, you know, geek toys, really.
Yeah.
A very specific type of geek.
Yeah. Well, the Kickstarter was, I'm looking at the page now, or crowd supply was really successful. And they, raised $56,000.
Yeah. And which I at the time, I just assumed it wasn't enough, but apparently it was.
Yeah. Well, the goal was a single dollar. So they're yeah. It was 5,627,000% funded.
Impressive. Yeah. Right, and should we move on to our final item of news? This, I was going to say fortnight then, but it's far longer than that.
This year.
Determinant chunk of time. This year. It's not the final item of news this year.
So far.
The winter does come.
Yeah. Trump's going quickly.
That's the news that the Killdisk malware has come to Linux. This is pretty nasty malware that basically just encrypts all your files, and apparently, if rumors are true, accidentally deletes the key, so the people who try and ransom you for the contents of your files can't actually decrypt it, even if you pay them. Whether or not this is deliberate or accidental is unknown.
I wonder if that affects their business model.
Well, it is a bit of a strange one, because for a long time, it was generally thought that if you paid, you got your files back. You know, there's a lot of different people doing it, but it was important for their business model, basically, that trust was there. You had to trust the people who had stolen your data. Otherwise, they've got no business model. You're not going to pay for something. Yeah. And that seems to have changed recently, in that now you're not that likely to get it back. Or you're less likely, even if you pay. So, usual warning supply, keep your software up to date, keep a good set of backups, and slaughter a chicken. And that's the news this period of time.
Excellent. That was a great news to start the year off with, Ben. So now it's time for finds of the, well, most of January and some part of December. It's late on a Tuesday night. I asked the IRC channel. There are no finds there, but the people are generally happy that we're coming back and recording some more stuff.
Hooray! That's a find in itself.
Yeah. James Olympus does say that we should tell everyone to check their backups. So that sounds like some hard-fought experience. Does anybody want to go first for their finds?
Me, please.
Can I go? Oh, go on then, Andrew.
Nah, in your face, Mike. In your face. So, my find is, I've got two finds. I've got a sad find, first of all, and a happy find. My first find is that Linux Luddites, that excellent podcast run by friends of the show, Joe, Paddy, and the beardy one, is no more. So after, I don't know, about 3 years maybe of blithering, they've just decided to stop, and it's all over. So thanks for all the fish, etc.
Does that mean new Linux is officially better than old Linux now?
maybe. It means that old Linux has got one less advocate. Maybe in this age of alternative facts, there's someone we could ask. I think you can just make up whatever nonsense you want, really.
Yeah. Is the cat dead or alive?
Send your answers on a postcode.
There is no wrong answer.
Just don't send the box.
So that brings us on to my second piece of news, which is that there's a new podcast. Born of the ashes of Linux Luddites, called Late Night Linux, which is Joe, that beardy fella, and also Ikey Doherty of Solus OS fame, and Phelim Whiteley, who is...
Phelim.
Yeah, Phelim, who can often be seen in the comments section of Linux Voice. So it's just lovely. It's lovely to hear Phelim's honeyed tones on over audio files. He's got such a lovely radio voice.
How long's it been running for?
2 or 3 podcasts, I think. Since the back end of December.
Okay. I shall check it out.
Do so.
I remember reading, I haven't listened to it yet, but is it, it's no longer family friendly, is that true?
But yeah, there is swearing. But it's late night, so it's past the, when you download it at 10 o'clock in the morning and put it on in the car, just imagine that it's late at night. Like Midnight Caller.
Yeah. Oh. Wow.
So that's that. That's my discovery. Two discoveries. My other discovery is that I've got a new job and I use Windows 10 at work. And, you know, I'd only ever dipped my toe into Windows and thought, ooh, I don't like this. And went back to Linux and OS 10. But now, using it on a day-to-day basis for hours at a time, it's just awful. It's really, really bad. I don't like it at all. There we go. It turns out we were right all along to be promoting this Linux malarkey because Windows is just so bad.
It's good now that we have an ambassador for Windows, though. We can ask you all the Windowsy stuff that
ambassador for Windows as Nigel Farage is an ambassador for the United Kingdom. He's not even an ambassador for Thanet South.
Oh, maybe there's a future for you on the Fox News channel then.
Oh, that'd be great. One day.
Okay. Sorry, Mike. Do you want to have a go?
Well, actually, now that Andrew mentions how bad Windows 10 is, I can also put that in as a fine because I'm having to use it for a couple of projects I'm working on occasionally, just occasionally. And in VirtualBox, whenever I boot it up, my network connection is completely saturated. And then I just do a quick job, make a screenshot, make a video, and then I try and shut it down. And of course, that then takes 20 minutes. It's the telemetry, it's the constant downloading of updates. Apparently, one Windows 10 user I saw on Reddit said that Windows 10 just installed and started running in the background Candy Crush for no reason. It just does this. It just does this. And it's so bad. There have always been enough things we've complained about in terms of Windows, you know, the reliability, the security, that have got a bit better over time. But you think they would sort this out. And it is almost to a point where it's unusable. I boot it up and it's just downloading and doing so much stuff in the background. It's not even, we're not just saying that like, oh, because we're Linux users. I find it completely unusable as a serious piece of software. But anyway, I have 3 quick finds, and I'll do them in order of usefulness, as in least useful first. The first one is called SFB, and it's a Flappy Bird clone written in SED. So SED is, of course, the streamed editor that you use to, with crazy long regular expressions to manipulate text. Ben, do I recall correctly, or am I too old? Didn't you write some sort of game in SED for Linux Voice?
I wrote a web framework in SED.
That was it. That's even funnier in a way because that's actually sounds quite serious as opposed to Flappy Bird.
If you're going to follow this up with something you say is more useful, you've set a pretty high bar. Because I really want to play Flappy Birds in SED now.
Yeah, well, we'll have the links in the podcast. Well, I'll send the links to Graham as well after this. The second find I had is something called the byte order mark. Sometimes when I'm opening up text documents, plain text documents in different editors like LibreOffice and AbbeyWord and stuff, there's this weird symbol that appears at the start. And it's happened to me loads over the years and I've never understood what it is. I just delete it and go about my way. But it's a Unicode thing. It tells the document processor or editor what the byte order is for the document. Has anybody else come across that?
Do you mean byte order as in little endian or big endian?
Yeah.
Do you mean
yeah.
one? Oh, yeah. Okay. No.
No, I've never done one.
Well, yeah. It's just, if I open a plain text document, maybe if I've saved it in a certain editor and I've opened it in LibreOffice or other things, then, this weird symbol appears. I thought it was a bug in LibreOffice or my editor or something. But if anybody else sees that, sees this weird character, now you know what it does. So that's sort of probably, 20% useful.
Yeah.
And my final find is actually very useful. It's a website called neversSL.com. Now, this is a website that guarantees to never use SSL. I'll read out the description. It says, this website is for when you try to open Facebook, Google, Amazon, etc. on a Wi-Fi network and nothing happens. Type http://neversSL.com into your browser's URL bar and you'll be able to log on. And this is for when you're connecting to a Wi-Fi network, usually like public Wi-Fi in airports or pubs or whatever, and it doesn't automatically give you a sign-in page. Yeah, what do they call those? Are it supplicants or something?
I know what you mean. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, so, a lot of Wi-Fi access points, they'll immediately pop you up with a sign-in page, but some of them don't do it for some reason.
Yeah.
So you try and go to browse to a page, and if it's a HTTPS page, a SSL page, then nothing will happen because it's trying to connect to the wireless router over SSL, and so your browser just kicks up an error. If you try to go to a plain HTTP site, then the access point redirects you to its login service where you, click terms and conditions or pay or whatever. So I've been using the BBC News website for that because I think I can access that in plain HTTP. But if you're trying to log onto a Wi-Fi network and everything seems screwed up and you can't be redirected, then go to neversSL.com. And it might actually save you. Those are my finds. Oh, I can't talk anymore.
Thanks, Mike. sounds good. I'll have to try it. Do you want to go next, Ben?
Yeah, I'll go next. I've got two finds. One of them has nothing to do with Linux at all, but I've been doing it quite a bit recently, and I'm quite excited by it. And the other one is quite Linuxy and it's been quite useful. So I've been cloning mushrooms, which sounds a bit weird, but to be honest, I don't really know why I'm doing it. But I guess it's one of those, I'm a natural tinkerer and I've started tinkering with biology as well as with computers now, which sounds a bit weird when you say it out loud. But yeah, decided to start growing mushrooms. And the way you start growing mushrooms is you start by getting a culture, which is like a syringe with like this cloudy stuff in it. And you inject it into this sort of pressure cooked or completely sterile sugar solution. And you get, I can show you guys, but obviously this isn't going to work over the audio podcast. You get like a jar with a golden fluid and a sort of cotton wool like cloudiness in it, which is the mushroom culture. And this one, so I've got two cultures going at the moment. I've got a shaggy ink cap and a blue oyster. Blue oyster. This one's a blue oyster. For listeners, it's a slightly smaller cloudy thing, and I can't work out why it's smaller than the shaggy ink cap. It's growing a lot slower for some reason.
And our listeners can't see the intense feelings of pride that seem to be painted across your face as you show us these either. Honestly, Ben, I don't think I've ever seen Ben so happy.
So, I've just showed you the liquid cultures. I've also got them growing on grain, which is actually bird seed. But they were growing a bit too wildly. So in the fridge to sort of, because I'm not ready, I haven't got the substrate ready to grow them on yet. The shaggy ink cap is actually going to end up going under the lawn. So I get little mushrooms popping up through the lawn that I can eat. Whereas the blue oyster is going to be grown on probably straw. And I'm going to try growing on hedge trimmings as well, just because I've got a hedge that needs trimming and I might as well try and grow something on that. And from a sort of separate set, I got given some grain spawn at the end of last year. And we grew some oyster mushrooms on straw from that. And we had them for dinner last night. They're really nice, just fried till they're a little crispy on the outside. So yeah, so I've got really looking forward to when those are ready.
Oh, that sounds brilliant.
And my more Linux related find is that I've been using so one of the things I'm working on is I've got a load of servers set up in a load of different places, cloud servers, physical servers, loads of different hosting providers, loads of stuff running on it, and we need a way of locking it down, keeping it secure, basically, you know, properly managing the system. I'm using Tinc, T-I-N-C, which is a mesh VPN, which allows all servers to connect to all the other servers and create a nice sort of mesh network using OpenSSL encryption. So everything's locked down. It's incredibly easy to set up. It's designed in such a way that a sort of automated deployment works really well, just pushing everything out to all the places, locks it down. Once that's set up, you can just forget about it. It's running. Everything's pushed across a nice encrypted network. Everything's properly authenticated. And it's one of those things that just works and was really easy to set up. So I highly recommend it if you're looking to secure a distributed network.
Excellent. Thank you, Ben. I've got a couple. First, I've got one that isn't Linux related. And this is, somebody sent me the link to this. I've forgotten their name. I'm sorry. But this is oscilloscope music written specifically by somebody called Jeroboam Fenderson. Now,
is that their real name or is that a
I don't know.
Stage name?
I don't know. I guess I should give it some explanation. You know, an oscilloscope basically maps an input signal onto an X and Y axis. So if it's an audio signal, it doesn't have to. Often it's used for voltages. And of course, audio is a certain kind of voltage when it's traveling down the wire. And so the X and the Y may be amplitude and frequency of a waveform. And so you typically see them in, you know, like science labs of the 1970s, where they'll have a sine wave repeating over the screen or something. They're on those old CRTs. Now, the clever thing is that you can manipulate the voltages to obviously draw onto the screen. So, in fact, this is how early arcade machines worked. The vector graphics, the vector images that were drawn for games like Asteroids or the early Star Wars games were written not with an oscilloscope, but with the beam, the electron beam being directed basically by an X and Y coordinates. And if you think about audio in the same way, you can also send the same kind of signals into an oscilloscope to draw pictures. So people have been drawing pictures with them for a while. What is remarkable about Jeroboam Fenderson's stuff is that they create 3D objects like Tetris cubes and pyramids, maps of the Earth in 3D. So they're obviously using some 3D software and then using their own. In fact, they did a Kickstarter to release the software that they're using to do this. To create all these amazing objects that present themselves on an oscilloscope. But the most remarkable thing, and the real find about it, is that the music, the actual raw sound that's being used to draw these images on an oscilloscope, sounds amazing. So it's not just like, I can't play it, but I'll put a link in the podcast notes. It's not random noise and infinite glitchiness, which is what you might expect, perhaps a little like listening to a loading cassette on an 80s home computer. It's actually
you might expect because it's drawing, or you might expect because it's music you're playing.
Well, I mean, it's not going to be for everybody, but it's fantastic. The combination, it's real masterpiece of audio engineering and of really musicianship. I think I've never seen anything like it. It's brilliant. They've created some tools to use with Pure Data, and I mean to look into it, but I think they've done such a brilliant job, I'm not sure I'll ever even get close. And my second one really isn't isn't that complicated. It's a simple PS1 prompt generator for your Bash RC configuration file, and it's actually a URL. It's a website where you can go to. So PS1 is the prompt that you see before, or typically the dollar sign on the command prompt, and you use it for the time or host name or directory location. And lots of people modify this. It can be modified usually with an environmental variable. But the clever thing about bashrcgenerator.com is that you can drag and drop different elements. You can tell them what color to be. You can reorder them and basically structure your PS1 prompt in like a WYSIWYG environment, and the site spits out the bashrc file that you need, or the bashrc PS1 variable that you just have to paste into your config file to get the PS1 prompt.
That's really cool. There have been a few sites like this recently, haven't they? I think I may have mentioned one, or somebody did in a find a while back, a cron tab generator, which website again, you know, reactive website, whatever you call them, you drag and drop the different things. And I think I saw another one for just creating general command line commands, you know, using pipes. So you say, oh, I want the output of this, and then I want to, you know, cut these bits out, and it will then come up with sed or, you know, other relevant tools. These things are really useful because they also teach you a lot. I think, you know, new users, they teach you a lot. They teach you how to visualize how these different things work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And to not be scared of them as well, you know, it's not that intimidating.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. It all looks like, you know, crazy moonspeak to a lot of people. But, you know, we're used to using commands like that. But, you're right, it really helps people to see the components.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. They were our finds.
And now, 43 minutes into the recording of the podcast, it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, that thing that Mike does with the thing where the people email in the things. Vocalize your neurons, that's it. And also the voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this, but in paper form, you can subscribe to Linux Magazine, where we write pages.
Hello?
Yes. Mike.
Is it me?
Yes. Are there any newer ones, Mike?
Well, I prefer the new title for the section, That Thing That Mike Does. but yeah, the number of things that thing that Mike does today is zero. So there are no things that what Mike thing does. But if anybody wants their thing to be done by Mike, email Mike at linuxvoice.com with that thing what Mike does. Oh, I'm too old for this. I'm tired.
Okay.
I just want to rest. Email me, Mike at linuxvoice.com.
Oh, poor Mike. Mike, it's probably late for you, isn't it, over in Germany? Is it about 3:30 in the morning?
It is, actually, yeah. It's 3:30 on Thursday afternoon, actually. And yeah, everything's upside down here. I'm battling on.
It's a good job we've got Brexit to protect us from your crazy continental time.
This is true. This is true, yeah.
Yeah, we're taking back control of time. We're going to make time great again and all that stuff. So that brings us rattling on to the voice of the masses, in which you asked, do we agree with the Free Software Foundation's high priority projects? So the Free Software Foundation has chosen to prioritise a fully free phone OS and cloud computing. But should they concentrate on other areas like desktop applications? Spoiler, no, they shouldn't. To make freedom respecting computing available to everyone, let us know your thoughts in the comments and we'll read out the best in our hour-longish audio compendium of fun, which is what this is. Amazing.
That's why I wrote that.
That's amazing. Almost as if you knew. insane stuff. So this priority list then, Mike, this I guess is
yes,
part of the FSF's manifesto for 2017. and the things that it wants to that it wants to happen. They've had enough of hanging around outside Apple stores, shouting at people, effectively trying to DDoS people that just want to listen to a few MP3s, and have instead taken a strategic look at the things that are important for free software and have decided that mobile OSs and cloud computing are the most important things. So that's where they'll turn their fire first.
Yeah, correct. You know, over the years, Richard Stallman has talked about how he's faced different battles, or however he's put it. You know, in the 1980s, his battle was to replace Unix with a free equivalent, and then, you know, when KDE came out and it was using Qt that wasn't under the most free software friendly license, he shifted his battlefront to the desktop, and now here we are in 2017. Yeah, and he and the Free Software Foundation say it's about mobile computing and so-called cloud computing. I know the Free Software Foundation really hates that term. So, you know, it's up to them what they choose to focus on. It's just interesting to see how much the wider community agrees with that. I mean, I still see the desktop as such an important thing to win. And I'm not sure how easy that is. You know, can you just throw a bunch of developers at Inkscape and GIMP to suddenly make them better? It might not be as simple as that.
Right, Mike. So let's move on from Mike to our first comment, which is from Mike, who says, nice to see that the FSF goes in mobile first, cloud first. What we lack is the hardware. We need free processors, graphics cards and motherboards, and free phone sockets, radios and so on. This comes back to the old, those open source chipboard things that you were talking about earlier. The cloud side, we need people to join Diaspora and other networks, otherwise they will never take off. So I think it should be hardware first, people first. Darren Drapkin, on the other hand, it is nice to see the FSF accepting that the cloud is an acceptable free software forum. The last time I heard, they were all for banning it. I don't think anyone at the FSF was ever in favour of banning cloud computing. It is always good to remember that it's the cloud. There is no cloud. It's just other people's computers, though.
Yes.
One of their priorities is decentralisation, federation and self-hosting, which I think is a really good thing to focus on.
That sounds fairly cloudy to me, actually.
Yeah, but with you being the provider of your own cloud, you know, rather than Google or whatever.
So Darren Drapkin, here is something that seems to share the FSF vision of a more decentralized cloud, serverless computing. Graham, do you want to tell us a bit more about why decentralized clouding is important?
That's like an A-level exam question.
In your own words.
Cite your sources.
But it is important because, you know, it's how most of us prefer to work. You know, we don't put everything into a single pot. I mean, that's why email, for example, has been so successful, and it's still used by a great number of people. You can trust it. There's nobody who has any kind of control over the email protocol and is the gatekeeper to that. And it should be I don't know whether it's too late, but the sheer volume of data. I mean, you get an Android phone or an iPhone, it's almost impossible to stop those devices uploading all your photos, all of your messages, everything to their own cloud services, which then are almost impossible to get off. You have to say no so many times, and that's for people like us who know about it. So the idea of federation and decentralization and hosting your own kind of equivalence, I think, is a very important one. I don't know. I mean, as a pragmatist, how to be most effective and how to provide a viable alternative to the maximal convenience that is really ripping through computing at the moment. And I understand the convenience, you know, we're doing this in Hangouts, and that's part of this. It it's the challenge, and this is perhaps my criticism with what the FSF is doing, is it's highlighting these projects. It's not saying in any way that it's going to do anything to help, other than saying this is what we think are priorities. And I think that's where we're lacking in ideas, is well, what, okay, great, what do we do about it? Nextcloud isn't good enough. You know, OwnCloud isn't good enough. There isn't an alternative to many social networking sites. There just isn't. There's no equivalent to Facebook. There's not even a close equivalent. And then asking for that to be federated on top of it, where, you know, we're a peer-to-peer network that has just as much influence as Facebook, is just, I don't know, it's science fiction.
Epicarnis says, I mostly agree with their priorities, but I think they're dooming themselves to useless on several of them. Free phone operating system in particular is going to be a problem. Mozilla, with substantially more money and developer time and influence with hardware manufacturers, flopped here for much the same reason I think Replicant is. Support is special for every single separate device because of the bits of special proprietary hardware and special kernel modifications and special binary blob drivers that everyone seems to depend on. The result is that you only get a handful of older phone models that can be made to work. Does that sound realistic to anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, so Replicants was built on CyanogenMod, and basically they stripped out a lot of the blobs. I'm not entirely sure it was all of them. So, I mean, they've done that in the past, and they'll, I assume, continue to do it in the future. But they did only support, a couple of models, and it takes a huge effort to build for new devices, stripping the blobs out. I mean, that's just a phenomenal amount of developer time that's needed. And just the sheer range of phones out there means if you just go and buy any phone out of the store, the chances of being able to get a completely free OS running on it are minimal and will be for the foreseeable future. But I guess it depends on what you see the goal as being. Does it mean you can live a modern life, you know, and have a smartphone and be connected to the world and that not run blobs? Or is it make it a viable choice for the average person on the street? You're never going to do the latter. The former is a realistic target.
So continuing on the vein of phones, Ray Wood says, yesterday I submitted a questionnaire from Marks & Spencer regarding ways of payment. Other high street stores are available, including those through mobile phones. Because of the lack of updates for older models, I've been very uncomfortable with the idea of payments through a mobile. If the Free Software Foundation can resolve this, even I may take up the idea. And Vlada says, coincidentally, I am considering buying a new phone and have been postponing it for a good while because I want a real Linux phone. Unfortunately, there's nothing decent available, or I'm not yet aware of it. So, yes, I agree with this priority. And he ends with saying, anyway, good to have you back, guys. That's us. So I think we've come to an agreement. I mean, it's quite late, you know. It's time to go to bed. Especially for Mike, because it's, what, next week for him. I think we agree with the Free Software Foundation that a free mobile phone OS is a priority, just as it was in 2007 when the iPhone was released. Congratulations, Free Software Foundation. Well done. Good luck. And it sounds like that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thanks ever so much for listening. Do we have any one last things or anything like that?
It's been a while since we've had a one last thing, isn't it? We used to have this sort of informal agreement that we'd interrupt each other, but not anymore.
Yeah, that was Paul's idea. Maybe we could ask listeners if they've got any suggestions for a new section or an old section they'd like us to revive in this 2017 season.
Yeah, that's right.
You mean the spinning wall of death, or what was it called again?
Wheel of Fortune. Yeah, or the challenges, although we never ever did them.
In the spirit of the late and actually not lamented at all Linux Luddites, because we've got late night Linux now. Is there anything that we used to do that you wanted us to do again because it's better than the stuff that we do now?
On that. Well, no, but it might. We've done this format for quite a long time. know, we could.
Yeah, we could. We should
swap out a section.
What would Bowie do?
Yeah, well, Bowie just wouldn't do the same podcast every 2 weeks.
Let's do something awesome. Let's all get blitzed on cocaine and then wake up tomorrow and find that we're on series 8. We don't know what happened for the last 3 years. Right then, listeners. Awesome. See you all in 2020. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
It's such a nice day.